This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Cannery Row, written by John Steinbeck, read by Jerry Farden.
Cannery Row in Monterey in California is a poem, a stink, a grating noise, a quality of light, a tone, a habit, a nostalgia, a dream. Cannery Row is the gathered and scattered, tin and iron and rust and splintered wood, chip pavement and weedy lots and junk heaps, sardine canneries of corrugated iron, honky-tonks, restaurants and whorehouses, and little crowded groceries and laboratories and flophouses. Its inhabitants are, as the man once said, whores, pimps, gamblers, and sons of bitches, by which he meant everybody. Had the man looked through another peephole, he might have said saints and angels and martyrs and holy men, and he would have meant the same thing. In the morning, when the sardine fleet has made a catch, the purse seiners waddle heavily into the bay, blowing their whistles. The deep-laden boats pull in against the coast where the canneries dip their tails into the bay. The figure is advisedly chosen, for if the canneries dip their mouths into the bay, the canned sardines which emerge from the other end would be, metaphorically at least, even more horrifying. Then cannery whistles scream, and all over the town men and women scramble into their clothes and come running down to the row to go to work. Then shining cars bring the upper classes down, superintendents, accountants, owners who disappear into offices. Then from the town pour wops and Chinamen and Polacks, men and women in trousers and rubber coats and oilcloth aprons. They come running to clean and cut and pack and cook and can the fish. The whole street rumbles and groans and screams and rattles while the silver rivers of fish pour in out of the boats, and the boats rise higher and higher in the water until they are empty. The canneries rumble and rattle and squeak until the last fish is cleaned and cut and cooked and canned, and then the whistles scream again, and the dripping, smelly, tired wops and Chinamen and Polacks, men and women, straggle out and droop their way up the hill into the town, and Cannery Row becomes itself again, quiet and magical. Its normal life returns. The bums, who retired in disgust under the black cypress tree, come out to sit on the rusty pipes in the vacant lot. The girls from Dora's emerge for a bit of sun, if there is any. Doc strolls from the Western Biological Laboratory and crosses the street to Lee Chong's grocery for 2 quarts of beer. Henri the painter noses like an Airedale through the junk in the grass-grown lot for some part or piece of wood or metal he needs for the boat he's building. Then the darkness edges in, and the streetlight comes on in front of Dora's, the lamp which makes perpetual moonlight in Cannery Row. Callers arrive at Western Biological to see Doc, and he crosses the street to Lee Chong's for 5 quarts of beer. How can the poem and the stink and the grating noise, the quality of light, the tone, the habit, and the dream, be set down alive? When you collect marine animals, there are certain flat worms so delicate that they are almost impossible to capture whole, for they break and tatter under the touch. You must let them ooze and crawl of their own will onto a knife blade, and then lift them gently into your bottle of seawater. And perhaps that might be the way to write this book, to open the page and to let the stories crawl in by themselves. Chapter 1. Lee Chong's Grocery, while not a model of neatness was a miracle of supply. It was small and crowded, but within its single room a man could find everything he wanted, or wanted to live and to be happy. Clothes, food, both fresh and canned, liquor, tobacco, fishing equipment, machinery, boats, cordage, caps, pork chops. You could buy at Lee Chong's a pair of slippers, a silk kimono, a quarter pint of whiskey, and a cigar. You could work out combinations to fit almost any mood. The one commodity Lee Chong did not keep could be had across the lot at Dora's. The grocery opened at dawn and did not close until the last wandering vagrant dime had been spent or retired for the night. Not that Lee Chong was avaricious. He wasn't. But if one wanted to spend money, he was available. Lee's position in the community surprised him as much as he could be surprised. Over the course of the years, everyone in Cannery Row owed him money. He never pressed his clients, but when the bill became too large, Lee cut off credit. Rather than walk into the town up the hill, the client usually paid, or tried to. Lee was round-faced and courteous. He spoke a stately English without ever using the letter R. When the Tong Wars were going on in California, it happened now and then that Lee found a price on his head. Then he would go secretly to San Francisco and enter a hospital until the trouble blew over. What he did with his money, no one ever knew. Perhaps he didn't get it. Maybe his wealth was entirely in unpaid bills. But he lived well, and he had the respect of all his neighbors. He trusted his clients until further trust became ridiculous. Sometimes he made business errors, but even these he turned to advantage in goodwill, if in no other way. It was that way with the Palace Flophouse and Grill. Anyone but Lee Chong would have considered the transaction a total loss. Lee Chong's station in the grocery was behind the cigar counter. The cash register was then on his left and the abacus on his right. Inside the glass case were the brown cigars, the cigarettes, the Bull Durham, the Duke's Mixture, the Five Brothers, while behind him in racks on the wall were the pints, half pints, and quarters of Old Green River, Old Townhouse, Old Colonel, and the favorite, Old Tennessee, a blended whiskey guaranteed 4 months old, very cheap, and known in the neighborhood as Old Tennis Shoes. Lee Chong did not stand between the whiskey and the customers without reason. Some very practical minds had on occasion tried to divert his attention to another part of the store. Cousins, nephews, sons, and daughters-in-law waited on the rest of the store, but Lee never left the cigar counter. The top of the glass was his desk. His fat, delicate hands rested on the glass, the fingers moving like small, restless sausages. A broad golden wedding ring on the middle finger of his left hand was his only jewelry, and with it he silently tapped on the rubber change mat from which the little rubber tits had long been worn. Lee's mouth was full and benevolent, and the flash of gold when he smiled was rich and warm. He wore half glasses, and since he looked at everything through them, he had to tilt his head back to see in the distance. Interest and discounts, addition, subtraction, he worked out on the abacus with his little restless sausage fingers, and his brown, friendly eyes roved over the grocery, and his teeth flashed at the customers. On an evening when he stood in his place on a pad of newspapers to keep his feet warm, he contemplated with humor and sadness a business deal that had been consummated that afternoon and reconsummated later that same afternoon. When you leave the grocery, if you walk catty-cornered across the grass-grown lot, threading your way among the great rusty pipes thrown out of the canneries, you will see a path worn in the weeds. Follow it past the cypress tree, across the railroad track, up a chicken walk with cleats, and you will come to a long, low building, which for a long time was used as a storage place for fish meal. It was just a great big roofed room, and it belonged to a worried gentleman named Horace Abbeville. Horace had two wives and six children, and over a period of years he had managed through pleading and persuasion to build a grocery debt second to none in Monterey. That afternoon he had come into the grocery, and his sensitive, tired face had flinched at the shadow of sternness that crossed Lee's face. Lee's fat finger tapped the rubber mat. Horace laid his hands palm up on the cigar counter.
"I guess I owe you plenty dough," he said simply.
Lee's teeth flashed up in appreciation of an approach so different from any he had ever heard. He nodded gravely, but he waited for the trick to develop. Horace wet his lips with his tongue, a good job from corner to corner.
"I hate to have my kids with that hanging over them," he said. "Why, I bet you wouldn't let them have a pack of spearmint now."
Lee Chong's face agreed with this conclusion.
"Plenty dough," he said.
Horace continued,
"You know that place of mine across the track up there where the fish meal is?"
Lee Chong nodded. It was his fish meal. Horace said earnestly,
"If I was to give you that place, would it clear me up with you?"
Lee Chong tilted his head back and stared at Horace through his half-glasses while his mind flicked among accounts and his right hand moved restlessly to the abacus. He considered the construction, which was flimsy, and the lot, which might be valuable if a cannery ever wanted to expand.
"Sure," said Lee Chong.
"Well, get out the accounts, and I'll make you a bill of sale on that place." Horace seemed in a hurry.
"No need papers," said Lee. "I make paid in full paper."
They finished the deal with dignity, and Lee Chong threw in a quarter pint of old tennis shoes. And then Horace Abbeville, walking very straight, went across the lot and past the cypress tree and across the track and up the chicken walk and into the building that had been his, and he shot himself on a heap of fish meal. And although it has nothing to do with this story, no Abbeville child, no matter who its mother was, knew the lack of a stick of spearmint ever afterward. But to get back to the evening, Horace was on the trestles with the embalming needles in him, and his two wives were sitting on the steps of his house with their arms about each other. They were good friends until after the funeral, and then they divided up the children and never spoke to each other again. Lee Chong stood in back of the cigar counter, and his nice brown eyes were turned inward on a calm, eternal Chinese sorrow. He knew he could not have helped it, but he wished he might have known and perhaps tried to help. It was deeply a part of Lee's kindness and understanding that man's right to kill himself is inviolable, but sometimes a friend can make it unnecessary. Lee had already underwritten the funeral and sent a wash basket of groceries to the stricken families. Now Lee Chong owned the Abbeville building, a good roof, a good floor, two windows and a door. True, it was piled high with fish meal, and the smell of it was delicate and penetrating. Lee Chong considered it as a storehouse for groceries, as a kind of warehouse, but he gave that up on second thought. It was too far away, and anyone can go in through a window. He was tapping the rubber mat with his gold ring and considering the problem when the door opened and Mac came in. Mac was the elder, leader, mentor, and to a small extent the exploiter of a little group of men who had in common no families, no money,
and no ambitions beyond food, drink, and contentment. But whereas most men in their search for contentment destroy themselves and fall wearily short of their targets, Mac and his friends approached contentment casually, quietly, and absorbed it gently. Mac and Hazel, a young man of great strength, Eddie, who filled in as a bartender at La Ida, Huey and Jones, who occasionally collected frogs and cats for Western Biological, were currently living in those large rusty pipes in the lot next to Lee Chong's. That is, they lived in the pipes when it was damp, but in fine weather they lived in the shadow of the black cypress tree at the top of the lot. The limbs folded down and made a canopy under which a man could lie and look at the flow and vitality of Cannery Row. Lee Chong stiffened ever so slightly when Mac came in, and his eyes glanced quickly about the store to make sure that Eddie or Hazel or Huey or Jones had not come in too and drifted away among the groceries. Mac laid out his cards with a winning honesty. "Lee," he said, "I and Eddie and the rest heard you own the Abbeville place." Lee Chong nodded and waited. "I and my friends thought we'd asked you if we could move in there. We'll keep up the property," he added quickly. "Wouldn't let anybody break in or hurt anything. Kids might knock out the windows, you know," Max suggested. "Place might burn down if somebody don't keep an eye on it." Lee tilted his head back and looked into Mac's eyes through the half-glasses, and Lee's tapping finger slowed its tempo as he thought deeply. In Mac's eyes there was goodwill and good fellowship and a desire to make everyone happy. Why, then, did Lee Chong feel slightly surrounded? Why did his mind pick its way as delicately as a cat through cactus? It had been sweetly done. Almost in a spirit of philanthropy, Lee's mind leaped ahead at the possibilities. No, they were probabilities, and his finger-tapping slowed still further. He saw himself refusing Mac's request, and he saw the broken glass from the windows. Then Mac would offer a second time to watch over and preserve Lee's property, and at the second refusal, Lee could smell the smoke, could see the little flames creeping up the walls. Mac and his friends would try to help to put it out. Lee's finger came to a gentle rest on the change mat. He was beaten. He knew that. There was left to him only the possibility of saving face, and Mac was likely to be very generous about that. Lee said, "You like pay lent my place? You like live there same hotel?" Mac smiled broadly, and he was generous. "Say," he cried, "that's an idea. Sure. How much?" Lee considered. He knew it didn't matter what he charged. He wasn't going to get it anyway. He might just as well make it a really sturdy face-saving sum. $5 a week, said Lee. Mac played it through to the end. "I'll have to talk to the boys about it," he said dubiously. "Couldn't you make that $4 a week? $5, said Lee firmly. "Well, I'll see what the boys say," said Mac. And that was the way it was. Everyone was happy about it. And if it be thought that Lee Chong suffered a total loss, at least his mind did not work that way. The windows were not broken, fire did not break out, and while no rent was ever paid, if the tenants ever had any money, and quite often they did have, it never occurred to them to spend it any place except at Lee Chong's grocery. What he had was a little group of active potential customers under wraps. But it went further than that. if a drunk caused trouble in the grocery, if the kids swarmed down from New Monterey intent on plunder, Lee Chong had only to call, and his tenants rushed to his aid. One further bond it established. You cannot steal from your benefactor. The saving to Lee Chong in cans of beans and tomatoes and milk and watermelons more than paid the rent. And if there was a sudden and increased leakage among the groceries in New Monterey, that was none of Lee Chong's affair. The boys moved in, and the fish meal moved out. No one knows who named the house that has been known ever after as the Palace Flophouse and Grill. In the pipes and under the cypress tree there had been no room for furniture, and the little niceties which are not only the diagnosis but the boundaries of our civilization. Once in the Palace Flophouse, the boys set about furnishing it. A chair appeared, and a cot, and another chair. A hardware store supplied a can of red paint, not reluctantly, because it never knew about it, and as a new table or footstool appeared, it was painted, which not only made it very pretty, but also disguised it to a certain extent in case a former owner looked in. And the Palace Flophouse and Grill began to function. The boys could sit in front of their door and look down across the track and across the lot and across the street right into the front windows of Western Biological. They could hear the music from the laboratory at night, and their eyes followed Doc across the street when he went to Lee Chong's for beer. And Mac said, "That Doc is a fine fella. We ought to do something for him."
Chapter 2. The word is a symbol and a delight which sucks up men and scenes, trees, plants, factories, and Pekingese. Then the thing becomes the word, and back to thing again, but warped and woven into a fantastic pattern. The word sucks up Cannery Row, digests it and spews it out, and the row has taken the shimmer of the green world and the sky-reflecting seas. Lee Chong is more than a Chinese grocer. He must be. Perhaps he is evil, balanced and held suspended by good, an Asiatic planet held to its orbit by the pull of Lao Tzu and held away from Lao Tzu by the centrifugality of abacus and cash register. Lee Chong, suspended, spinning, whirling among groceries and ghosts. A hard man with a can of beans, a soft man with the bones of his grandfather. For Lee Chong dug into the grave on China Point and found the yellow bones, the skull with gray ropey hair still sticking to it, and Lee carefully packed the bones, femurs and tibias really straight, skull in the middle, with pelvis and clavicle surrounding it and ribs curving on either side. Then Lee Chong sent his boxed and brittle grandfather over the western sea to lie at last in ground made holy by his ancestors. Mac and the boys, too, spinning in their orbits. They are the virtues, the graces, the beauties of the hurried, mangled craziness of Monterey and the cosmic Monterey, where men in fear and hunger destroy their stomachs in the fight to secure certain food, where men, hungering for love, destroy everything lovable about them. Mac and the boys are the beauties, the virtues, the graces. In the world ruled by tigers with ulcers, rutted by strictured bulls, scavenged by blind jackals, Mac and the boys dine delicately with the tigers, fondle the frantic heifers, and wrap up the crumbs to feed the seagulls of Cannery Row. What can it profit a man to gain the whole world and to come to his property with a gastric ulcer, a blown prostate, and bifocals?
Mac and the boys avoid the trap, walk around the poison, step over the noose, while a generation of trapped, poisoned, and trussed-up men scream at them and call them no goods, come to bad ends, blots on the town, thieves, rascals, bums. Our Father, who art in nature, who has given the gift of survival to the coyote, the common brown rat, the English sparrow, the housefly, and the moth, must have a great and overwhelming love for no-goods and blots on the town and bums and Mac and the boys. Virtues and graces and laziness and zest. Our Father, who art in nature. Chapter 3. Lee Chong's is to the right of the vacant lot, although why it is called vacant when it is piled high with old boilers, with rusting pipes, with great square timbers, and stacks of 5-gallon cans, no one can say. Up and back of the vacant lot is the railroad track and the palace flophouse, but on the left-hand boundary of the lot is the stern and stately whorehouse of Dora Flood, a decent, clean, honest, old-fashioned sporting house where a man can take a glass of beer among friends. This is no fly-by-night cheap clip joint, but a sturdy, virtuous club, built, maintained, and disciplined by Dora, who, madam and girl for 50 years, has, through the exercise of special gifts of tact and honesty, charity, and a certain realism, made herself respected by the intelligent, the learned, and the kind. And by the same token, she is hated by the twisted and lascivious sisterhood of married spinsters whose husbands respect the home but don't like it very much. Dora is a great woman, a great big woman with flaming orange hair and a taste for Nile green evening dresses. She keeps an honest, one-price house, sells no hard liquor, and permits no loud or vulgar talk in her house. Of her girls, some are fairly inactive due to age and infirmities, but Dora never puts them aside, although, as she says, some of them don't turn 3 tricks a month, but they go right on eating 3 meals a day. In a moment of local love, Dora named her place the Bear Flag Restaurant, and the stories are many of people who have gone in for a sandwich. There are normally 12 girls in the house, counting the old ones, a Greek cook, and a man who is known as a watchman, but who undertakes all manner of delicate and dangerous tasks. He stops fights, ejects drunks, soothes hysteria, cures headaches, and tends bar. He bandages cuts and bruises, passes the time of day with cops, and since a good half of the girls are Christian Scientists, reads aloud his share of Science and Health on a Sunday morning. His predecessor, being a less well-balanced man, came to an evil end, as shall be reported, but Alfred has triumphed over his environment and has brought his environment up with him. He knows what men should be there and what men shouldn't be there. He knows more about the home life of Monterey citizens than anyone in town. As for Dora, she leads a ticklish existence. Being against the law, at least against its letter, she must be twice as law-abiding as anyone else. There must be no drunks, no fighting, no vulgarity, or they close Dora up. Also, being illegal, Dora must be especially philanthropic. Everyone puts the bite on her. If the police give a dance for their pension fund, and everyone else gives $1, Dora has to give $50. When the Chamber of Commerce improved its gardens, the merchants each gave $5, but Dora was asked for and gave $100. With everything else, it's the same. Red Cross, Community Chest, Boy Scouts. Dora's unsung, unpublicized, shameless, dirty wages of sin lead the list of donations. but during the Depression she was hardest hit. In addition to the usual charities, Dora saw the hungry children of Cannery Row and the jobless fathers and the worried women, and Dora paid grocery bills right and left for 2 years and very nearly went broke in the process. Dora's girls are well-trained and pleasant. They never speak to a man on the street, although he may have been in the night before. Before Alfie, the present watchman, took over, there was a tragedy in the Bear Flag restaurant which saddened everyone. The previous watchman was named William, and he was a dark and lonesome-looking man. In the daytime, when his duties were few, he would grow tired of female company. Through the windows, he could see Mac and the boys sitting on the pipes in the vacant lot, dangling their feet in the mallow weeds and taking the sun while they discoursed slowly and philosophically of matters of interest but of no importance. Now and then, as he watched them, he saw them take out a pint of old tennis shoes and, wiping the neck of the bottle on a sleeve, raise the pint one after another. And William began to wish he could join that good group. He walked out one day and sat on the pipe. Conversation stopped, and an uneasy and hostile silence fell on the group. After a while, William went disconsolately back to the Bear Flag, and through the window he saw the conversation spring up again, and it saddened him. He had a dark and ugly face and a mouth twisted with brooding. The next day he went again, and this time he took a pint of whiskey. Mac and the boys drank the whiskey. After all, they weren't crazy. But all the talking they did was good luck and looking at you. After a while, William went back to the Bear Flag, and he watched them through the window, and he heard Mac raise his voice, saying, "But God damn it, I hate a pimp." Now, this was obviously untrue, although William didn't know that. Mac and the boys just didn't like William. Now William's heart broke. The bums would not receive him socially. They felt that he was too far beneath them. William had always been introspective and self-accusing. He put on his hat and walked out along the sea, clear out to the lighthouse, and he stood in the pretty little cemetery where you can hear the waves drumming always. William thought dark and broody thoughts. No one loved him. No one cared about him. They might call him a watchman, but he was a pimp. A dirty pimp. The lowest thing in the world. And then he thought how he had a right to live and be happy just like anyone else. By God, he had. He walked back angrily, but his anger went away when he came to the Bear Flag and climbed the steps. It was evening, and the jukebox was playing Harvest Moon, and William remembered that the first hooker who ever gaffed for him used to like that song before she ran away and got married and disappeared. The song made him awfully sad. Dora was in the back parlor having a cup of tea when William came in. She said, "What's the matter, you sick?" "No," said William. "But what's the percentage? I feel lousy. I think I'll bump myself off." Dora had handled plenty of neurotics in her time. "Kid 'em out of it," was her motto. "Well, do it on your own time and don't mess up the rug," she said. A gray, damp cloud folded over William's heart, and he walked slowly out and down the hall and knocked on Eva Flanagan's door. She had red hair and went to confession every week. Eva was quite a spiritual girl with a big family of brothers and sisters, but she was an unpredictable drunk. She was painting her nails and messing them pretty badly when William went in, and he knew she was bagged, and Dora wouldn't let a bagged girl work. Her fingers were nail polished to the first joint, and she was angry. "What's eating you?" she said. William grew angry, too. "I'm going to bump myself off," he said fiercely. Eva screeched at him. "That's a dirty, lousy, stinking sin," she cried. And then, "Wouldn't it be like you to get the joint pinched just when I got almost enough kick to take a trip to East St. Louis? You're a no-good bastard!" She was still screaming at him when William shut her door after him and went to the kitchen. He was very tired of women. The Greek would be restful after women. The Greek, big apron, sleeves rolled up, was frying pork chops in two big skillets, turning them over with an ice pick. "Hello, Kitz. How is going things?" The pork chops hissed and swished in the pan. "I don't know, Lou," said William. "Sometimes I think the best thing to do would be cluck." He drew his finger across his throat. The Greek laid the ice pick on the stove and rolled his sleeves higher. "I'll tell you what I hear, Kitz," he said. "I hear like the fella talks about it, don't never do it." William's hand went out for the ice pick, and he held it easily in his hand. His eyes looked deeply into the Greek's dark eyes, and he saw disbelief and amusement. And then, as he stared, the Greek's eyes grew troubled, and then worried. And William saw the change, saw first how the Greek knew he could do it, and then the Greek knew he would do it. As soon as he saw that in the Greek's eyes, William knew he had to do it. He was sad, because now it seemed silly. His hand rose, and the ice pick snapped into his heart. It was amazing how easily it went in. William was the watchman before Alfred came. Everyone liked Alfred. He could sit on the pipes with Mac and the boys any time. He could even visit up at the Palace Flophouse. Chapter 4. In the evening, just at dusk, a curious thing happened on Cannery Row. It happened in the time between sunset and the lighting of the streetlight. There is a small, quiet, gray period then, down the hill, past the Palace Flophouse, down the chicken walk and through the vacant lot, came an old Chinaman. He wore an ancient flat straw hat, blue jeans, both coat and trousers, and heavy shoes of which one sole was loose so that it slapped the ground when he walked. In his hand he carried a covered wicker basket. His face was lean and brown and corded as jerky, and his old eyes were brown, even the whites were brown and deep-set so that they looked out of holes. He came by just at dusk and crossed the street and went through the opening between Western Biological and the Hediondo Cannery. Then he crossed the little beach and disappeared among the piles and steel posts which support the piers. No one saw him again until dawn. But in the dawn, during that time when the street light has been turned off and the daylight has not come, the old Chinaman crept out from among the piles, crossed the beach and the street. His wicker basket was heavy and wet and dripping now. His loose sole flap-flapped on the street. He went up the hill to the second street, went through a gate in a high board fence, and was not seen again until evening. People, sleeping, heard his flapping shoe go by, and they awakened for a moment. It had been happening for years, but no one ever got used to him. Some people thought he was God, and very old people thought he was death, and children thought he was a very funny old Chinaman, as children always think anything old and strange is funny. But the children did not taunt him or shout at him as they should, for he carried a little cloud of fear about with him. Only one brave and beautiful boy of 10 named Andy from Salinas ever crossed the old Chinaman. Andy was visiting in Monterey, and he saw the old man and knew he must shout at him, if only to keep his self-respect. But even Andy, brave as he was, felt the little cloud of fear. Andy watched him go by evening after evening while his duty and his terror wrestled. And then one evening, Andy braced himself and marched behind the old man, singing in a shrill falsetto, "Ching chong Chinaman sitting on a rail, long came a white man and chopped off his tail." The old man stopped and turned. Andy stopped. The deep brown eyes looked at Andy, and the thin corded lips moved. What happened then, Andy was never able either to explain or to forget, for the eyes spread out until there was no Chinaman. And then it was one eye, one huge brown eye as big as a church door. Andy looked through the shiny, transparent brown door, and through it he saw a lonely countryside, flat for miles, but ending against a row of fantastic mountains shaped like cows and dogs' heads and tents and mushrooms. There was low, coarse grass on the plain, and here and there a little mound, and a small animal like a woodchuck sat on each mound. And the loneliness, the desolate, cold aloneness of the landscape, made Andy whimper, because there wasn't anybody at all in the world, and he was left. Andy shut his eyes so he wouldn't have to see it anymore, and when he opened them, he was in Cannery Row, and the old Chinaman was just flapping between Western Biological and the Hediondo Cannery. Andy was the only boy who ever did that, and he never did it again. Chapter 5. Western Biological was right across the street and facing the vacant lot. Lee Chong's grocery was on its catty corner right, and Dora's Bear Flag restaurant was on its catty corner left. Western Biological deals in strange and beautiful wares. It sells the lovely animals of the sea, the sponges, tuna cates, anemones, the stars and bottle stars, and sun stars, the bivalves, barnacles, the worms and shells, the fabulous and multiform little brothers, the living, moving flowers of the sea, nudibranchs and tectibranchs, the spiked and knobbed and needly urchins, the crabs and demi-crabs, the little dragons, the snapping shrimps, and ghost shrimps so transparent that they hardly throw a shadow. And Western Biological sells bugs, and snails, and spiders, and rattlesnakes, and rats, and honeybees, and Gila monsters. These are all for sale. Then there are little unborn humans, some whole, and others sliced thin and mounted on slides. And for students, there are sharks with the blood drained out, and yellow and blue color substituted in veins and arteries, so that you may follow the system with a scalpel. And there are cats with colored veins and arteries, and frogs the same. You can order anything living from Western Biological, and sooner or later you will get it. It is a low building facing the street. The basement is the storeroom with shelves, shelves clear to the ceiling loaded with jars of preserved animals. And in the basement is a sink and instruments for embalming and for injecting. Then you go through the backyard to a covered shed on piles over the ocean, and here are the tanks for the larger animals, the sharks and rays and octopi, each in their concrete tanks. There is a stairway up the front of the building and a door that opens into an office where there is a desk piled high with unopened mail, filing cabinets, and a safe with the door propped open. Once the safe got locked by mistake and no one knew the combination, and in the safe was an open can of sardines and a piece of Roquefort cheese. Before the combination could be sent by the maker of the lock, there was trouble in the safe. It was then that Doc devised a method for getting revenge on a bank if anyone should ever want to. "Rent a safety deposit box," he said. then deposit in it one whole fresh salmon, and go away for 6 months. After the trouble with the safe, it was not permitted to keep food there any more. It is kept in the filing cabinets. Behind the office is a room wherein aquaria are many living animals. There also are the microscopes and the slides and the drug cabinets, the cases of laboratory glass, the workbenches and little motors, the chemicals. From this room come smells, formalin and dry starfish and seawater and menthol, carbolic acid and acetic acid, smell of brown wrapping paper and straw and rope, smell of chloroform and ether, smell of ozone from the motors, smell of fine steel and thin lubricant from the microscopes, smell of banana oil and rubber tubing, smell of drying wool socks and boots, sharp, pungent smell of rattlesnakes, and musty, frightening smell of rats. And through the back door comes the smell of kelp and barnacles when the tide is out, and the smell of salt and spray when the tide is in. To the left, the office opens into a library. The walls are bookcases to the ceiling, boxes of pamphlets and separates, books of all kinds, dictionaries, encyclopedias, poetry, plays. A great phonograph stands against the wall with hundreds of records lined up beside it. Under the window is a redwood bed, and on the walls and to the bookcases are pinned reproductions of Daumier and Graham, Titian and Leonardo and Picasso, Dali and George Grosz, pinned here and there at eye level so that you can look at them if you want to. There are chairs and benches in this little room, and of course the bed. As many as 40 people have been here at one time. Behind this library, or music room, or whatever you want to call it, is the kitchen, a narrow chamber with a gas stove, a water heater, and a sink. But whereas some food is kept in the filing cabinets in the office, dishes and cooking fat and vegetables are kept in glass-fronted sectional bookcases in the kitchen. No whimsy dictated this, it just happened. From the ceiling of the kitchen hang pieces of bacon and salami and black beige de mer. Behind the kitchen is a toilet and a shower. The toilet leaked for 5 years until a clever and handsome guest fixed it with a piece of chewing gum. Doc is the owner and operator of the Western Biological Laboratory. Doc is rather small, deceptively small, for he is wiry and very strong, and when passionate anger comes on him, he can be very fierce. He wears a beard, and his face is half Christ and half satyr, and his face tells the truth. It is said that he has helped many a girl out of one trouble and into another. Doc has the hands of a brain surgeon and a cool, warm mind. Doc tips his hat to dogs as he drives by, and the dogs look up and smile at him. He can kill anything for need, but he could not even hurt a feeling for pleasure. He has one great fear, that of getting his head wet, so that summer or winter he ordinarily wears a rain hat. He will wade in a tide pool up to the chest without feeling damp, but a drop of rainwater on his head makes him panicky. Over a period of years, Doc dug himself into Cannery Row to an extent not even he suspected. He became the fountain of philosophy and science and art. In the laboratory, the girls from Dora's heard the plain songs and Gregorian music for the first time. Li Chong listened while Li Po was read to him in English. Henri the painter heard for the first time the Book of the Dead, and was so moved that he changed his medium. Henri had been painting with glue, iron rust, and colored chicken feathers, but he changed, and his next four paintings were done entirely with different kinds of nutshells. Doc would listen to any kind of nonsense and change it for you to a kind of wisdom. His mind had no horizon, and his sympathy had no warp.
He could talk to children, telling them very profound things so that they understood. He lived in a world of wonders, of excitement. He was concupiscent as a rabbit and gentle as hell. Everyone who knew him was indebted to him, and everyone who thought of him thought next, "I really must do something nice for Doc." Chapter 6. Doc was collecting marine animals in the great tide pool on the tip of the peninsula. It is a fabulous place. When the tide is in, a wave-churned basin, creamy with foam, whipped by the combers that roll in from the whistling buoy on the reef. But when the tide goes out, the little water world becomes quiet and lovely. The sea is very clear, and the bottom becomes fantastic with hurrying, fighting, feeding, breeding animals. Crabs rush from frond to frond of the waving algae. Starfish squat over mussels and limpets, attach their million little suckers, and then slowly lift with incredible power until the prey is broken from the rock. And then the starfish stomach comes out and envelops its food. Orange and speckled and fluted nudibranchs slide gracefully over the rocks, their skirts waving like the dresses of Spanish dancers, and black